All right, so this afternoon I'd like to explore what's called the three characteristics. So before we go into that for a moment, most of us have just finished this 6-week series, which is really teaching us how to pay attention, how to see clearly without distortion, to see the distortion of thought and how it labels, how it places things, how it creates a level of resistance, to actually see through that. To actually make direct contact with how this moment is. And not only a steady attention, but a gentle, a kind, not with non-resistance quality of attention. This becomes the optimum conditions for us to see and understand ourselves in a deeper way. This is why it's called insight practice, is to understand ourselves and our basic assumptions in a profoundly different way. Insight meditation is to clear our distortions of how we see life, to directly see how life really is, to see through our projections. And there's many examples and ways this happens on our meditation in our daily lives, the assumptions of our relationships to thought. Now, in terms of meditation, and particularly from the Buddhist tradition, this type of meditation is particularly focused on seeing three areas. It's called the three characteristics. Now, it comes from the Buddhist tradition, but please hold it not as being religious. It's not like you're going to be asked to believe anything or adopt any belief. It's not, or to adopt a philosophy. But it's actually instead to see how these areas show up in our experience. The meditation tools allows us to see how these actually are seen and actually show up in the laboratory of our lives, in the laboratory of our relationships, our relationship to ourselves and others. And so hold that not as something that you need to adopt or believe, but see if you can see that from your own experience, from this retreat, from this class, from your years of meditating, if you're very experienced. See if they are true or not true in your own experience. These three characteristics are said to apply to all conditioned things, all conditioned phenomenon. Okay, so this word conditioned is so interesting. It's like a plant is conditioned based on a seed, soil, warmth, nutrients, water. Those conditions come together to allow that seed to come forth. Same thing with as a human being. Each one of us started as an embryo. We had certain conditions come together. And if those were right, we were able to develop into a fetus and then finally to be born. And then our life's experiences, how we were nurtured and raised, the trauma, the abuse, whatever it might have been, the joyful experiences, our schooling, all those things start to form who we are. It's all conditions, all based on a series of conditions that came together to create who we are. And this also happens in a mind state, a particular perspective, a personality, that also these conditions come together to create that state to arise. And you start to unpack that and see that as a meditator. So what are these three conditions, these three marks of existence? So the first one is dukkha. So I'm going to use the Pali word to help kind of bring your experience to that, exposure to that, but also the Pali word. Pali is a language of verbs. And so sometimes the English translation doesn't always fit. The English translation sometimes is too noun focused, too stable in its thing versus a sense of process, a verb. So dukkha is the unsubstantial, the insufficient, the impermanent aspect of what's conditioned. Another way of saying it is suffering. This is the most common definition. So meditation, hopefully you've had experiences of noticing how you may have an unpleasant experience. Let's say it's a back pain or an emotion. And you may have noticed that how you relate to that discomfort can either amplify the pain or decrease it. Okay, so if we add resistance to it, if we try to push against it, if we really personify it, make it mean something about us, we amplify that pain. While if we're able to meet it without resistance or with less resistance and without a sense of self-identification, suddenly we're relating to that experience in a different way. There's a way that the added on suffering, the optional suffering, falls away. A famous sutta, the Buddha describes this very graphically, that he says a person who's practiced many years or someone who's never practiced, if they get hit by a dart, like a little arrow, they're both going to experience the pain of that wound. Now, someone who's practiced is able to just feel that, and that's all. Just feel the experience of that pain and the suffering of that. Someone who's not practiced starts to add a whole lot more suffering around that. They start to rant and rave, and you know, this sutta talks about beating your chest and lamenting and getting very worked up. I think we all can identify with that experience. We stub our toe and we run around yelling at whoever left whatever object is in the wrong place. We blame, we project outward, we write letters and emails. We amplify the pain. And this is one aspect of dukkha, of this quality of unsatisfactoriness that we add to the moment. So each of these three characteristics, we can see how meditation gives us a key to release that, to actually become aligned with that. Another area of suffering is the fact that things are constantly changing, in the constant state of flux. And when we mistake something as being solid, as being unchanging, when it actually is changing, we experience suffering. If for those of you in my class, I read the Shihab Nye poetry, Kindness. One of the lines is, "What you counted and what you carefully saved, all this must go like salt in a weakened broth." You know, this sense of, I count on this to last forever. I count on save it, and it dissolves in a moment as life's conditions happen. This is another aspect of dukkha, this quality of suffering. When we mistake what is actually inherently in flux, always in change, as solid. And the more we hold it as being solid, the more suffering we'll experience. This is the characteristic of dukkha, of that unsubstantial, insufficient, impermanent. And this characteristic leads into the next one, that is of anicca, of impermanence, that all conditioned things are impermanent. You know, they come together because of certain conditions. So even something that's substantial, like, you know, this house that I'm living in, you know, it's substantial, it's lasted here longer than I've been alive, and it may last longer than I live. And yet, over time, it's still degrading, it's still falling apart. There's cracks forming here, and things are falling apart. You know, so we have to put energy to try to resist that sense of falling apart. You know, the sense of weather is a beautiful example. That last week, yeah, just a week ago, the conditions were right for snow to fall here in Seattle. You know, and yet, those conditions are rare. The human body, the way our health is, these conditions come together and there's a result from them. And of course, the mind state, how we relate to experience, kind of sets up the next mind state to arise. So impermanence is this law of change, of this arising and passing away. And as meditators, we get to see this really directly. And we're actually looking at it all the time. But calling it out, naming it out, can be so helpful. You know, just noticing how the breath is constantly changing. You don't just breathe in and stay inhaled. You have to exhale. You know, a painful sensation, if you've explored that in meditation and open to it with curiosity, without resistance, you start to see how that very solid thing starts to shift. It starts to have maybe different qualities that we thought were stiff or were solid. And then our own mind state. I mean, how many times have we woken up and said, okay, I'm in a grumpy mood. And then something changes. We hear a bird. we hear a compliment, we see something that opens our heart, and that mind state suddenly dissolves into something else. All examples of impermanence. And seeing how sounds arise and pass away, sensations, thoughts. Everything is in a process, everything that's conditioned is in a process of flux and flow. And yet, we often try to stop that flow. We try to resist it. You know, the inevitable aging of our bodies. You know, there's a sense of taking care of ourselves and trying to promote our health as long as possible. And yet, there is the fact that we will get older. We will experience illness. We'll experience death. It's part of the three heavenly messengers that brought the Buddha to this practice, is that waking up from his assumption of things always being perfect, always being beautiful, to actually see the reality that his human body will also have this aging, also have this illness, also have this death. So we try to stop that flux. We try to change that flow. We try to keep the things which are pleasant to last as long as possible. I don't know if I shared this example or not, but it's a humorous one for those of you who have children or grandchildren. And my daughter was in preschool. We were visiting the beach for a field trip, and they were out building sandcastles, and the tide was coming in, and the kids were so involved in trying to keep the water from coming up, you know, building extra walls and, you know, diverting channels to get the water away. And, you know, I was playing with them and, you know, trying to help them with this losing battle. And it always struck me at how this is how we often relate to what's impermanent. You know, the tide will come in, the tide will go out. And when we try to stop it, that's when we experience suffering. That's when we experience that sense of tightness, that sense of dukkha. And if we look at it from the other direction, is actually embracing the fact of change, then we're suddenly living life from a great place of grace, a place of ease. Like, okay, this is now how this is in this moment, not how I wish it was. And there's an ease that comes from that that is quite profound. Now, impermanence, that sense of flux and change, is something that we can see externally if we look. You know, the seasons changing. But it also relates to us as human beings and our mind state and that very sense of identity and how that's always changing too. I know that looking at the range of age here on the retreat and through the classes, there's some people in an early stage in their careers and there's this kind of growth. And there's people who are getting ready to retire, who have retired. There's people who are just having children, and people having children leaving the home or having children of their own. These are all changes of our role, changes of our sense of who we are. Also, this quality of impermanence. And this leads to the third characteristic, that of anatta, or anatta, of non-self. So non-self is one of the more subtle and difficult things to understand, but it's meant to be not a philosophy, but a direct experience to actually see the truth of that. Now, the thing about non-self is that there's the important thing between the relative versus the absolute. So there's a relative self. There's a relative self who knows how to do their job, to step into a role and be effective. And that role is always changing. That person is always changing in different ways. The impermanence is happening. So the relative reality is that there's this navigational self that knows how to move through life. Now the trouble is that for most of us, that navigational self is taken as being the absolute truth. Well, if we look closely, we start to see that that sense of me isn't always there. And especially if we call our attention to it, like we did with that choiceless awareness, people reported how that sense of being more porous, being more diffuse, being more spacious, and how there's that sense of something has lifted. There's some constraint that has fallen away. And there's a sense of wonder with that. And this is a taste, a glimpse of that thinning of self, that falling away of that perspective. And people also reported that bit of like, okay, well, if I'm not here, then what's happening? That sense of being disconcerted, that little bit of worry or anxiety, sometimes even fear, terror can come up. Because really this territory starts to look at this underlying premise that there's an I, me, and mine. There's a lasting sense of me that's unchanging. And when it falls away, you get a glimpse of it thinning. That underlying premise that your whole life has been based upon becomes questioned. And the self can be threatened by that. It can be, the ego can be worried because there's a sense of dissolving. It's in some ways is a form of dying in the moment, dying before you die. Until we start to understand the navigational self is still available, it still arises when it's needed to know how to say, okay, this is Tim, this is Deb, this is Steve. That comes up, that's understood, but it's not believed in as an absolute truth. So in that choiceless awareness or any some other times in the meditation when you felt a sense of stillness, a sense of quiet that seemed to kind of rise up of its own, that it wasn't so self-directed. You may have noticed the sense of you becomes less distinct. You know, the sense of the body outline starts to become amorphous. Even the sense of your opinions that you so often rely on start to be seen more and more just as another thought, the randomness of thought. This requires us to start to relax some of the deeper agenda, this deeper control that we place upon the world. This world's always in flux, always in change. So of course we want to try to stabilize that. But this is what creates so much suffering. The Buddha reflected, after he became awakened, reflected back to his time before he became awakened. He realized that, okay, here I am, someone trying to find stability, trying to find lasting happiness in a world that's constantly changing, that's inherently impermanent. And even worse, I am also impermanent. My mind states are constantly changing. So like two things were constantly in flux, trying to find some place of stability. You realized how impossible that was. And a few weeks ago, I was walking through my neighborhood park and I saw a pileated woodpecker pecking on a tree. And it was really close to the trail. And it was just amazing to see that. And I knew that this is fleeting. You know, this is not going to last forever. And I knew that, okay, there's me who's enjoying this. And I wanted to capture that moment. I ran home to get my camera. All the while I was noticing, okay, here is a form of suffering. Trying to consolidate myself around something I know is going to be changing. And sure enough, by the time I got back, the woodpecker was gone. Just the hole the woodpecker had created in the tree, in the snag. And so often we do this. We try to fix ourselves and place our hopes on something which is also changing. So this is a process of thinning, a sense of softening the sense of me. This is going beyond from a dharmic standpoint, all that peace, that ease, that relief from your mind's contraction is really a side effect. It's really a side effect. It's an important side effect, and it may be what draws you to the practice and to honor that. And from a dharmic standpoint, it's really looking at these three characteristics. You know, from my perspective, particularly the sense of anatta, of non-self, to start to see this core assumption of I, of me, of mine, is just another thought. That sense of I, of me and mine, is just another thought. Now, you hear that. And you reflect when you're meditating on how random your thoughts are. They come up, they pop, they hear, they're there. And what if that sense of me was just one that was more consolidated, more believed in? There's more of a sense of unconsciously seeing the validity of it. They start to see that sense of anicca, of impermanence, that affects, relates to you. Then suddenly these characteristics have a very different experience. And again, there could be the fear around it. That's the fear of the self. I'm being unemployed. I have no role. But if we can move through that fear, allow ourselves to relax into that, there's a depth of peace that goes beyond our conditions, the conditions of our lives. So much of our lives' happiness is based on the conditions. I have pleasant people around me. I have enough food to eat, enough money in the bank, or the absence of those. And that creates our sense of suffering. So how this points to how can we find that ease, that peace, regardless of the circumstances. And so anatta, non-self, relates back to dukkha. In fact, that's probably the most important aspect of dukkha, is whenever we take something, personify it, contract around a sense of self, we will feel dukkha. We will feel suffering, guaranteed. Because that sense of self cannot last. It will change. It might be painful while it's there and we feel the dukkha there. We may feel the pain as it passes. The more invested we are, the more suffering we'll have. And conversely, the more lightly we hold ourselves, the more ease we have. So these three characteristics, these marks of conditioned phenomenon, of dukkha, of anicca, sense of impermanence, and anatta, of non-self, these are meant to be things we see directly in our practice. This is the whole point of insight practice from a dharmic perspective, is learning to see these as alive truths in your own experience, not as an abstract philosophy, but something we can see directly. Now, to conclude, I define the three characteristics as they are apply to all conditioned things. Everything that's conditioned has these three characteristics. But the Buddha said there's also something that's not conditioned. There's something that's outside of these three characteristics. And that was really what he discovered, is what is unconditioned. Sometimes he called it what is the deathless, what is not arising in state of birth, of identity, of falling away. Now that sense of what's unconditioned is something that each one of you likely have had a taste of that. There are times when you're simply maybe opening to choiceless awareness and you just feel that sense of something else is what's observing, something else is what's present. That's not going through you. That's the unconditioned. That's why we point to that right from the beginning. What holds whatever is present? It doesn't matter what's present, because we're learning to notice that what's unconditioned, the very quality of awareness itself. The very quality of awareness itself. And so you explore that, you learn that sometimes in very, you know, concrete, small ways, learning how to have less resistance. That's starting to layer off that quality of conditionality. You start to relate to life from this place of immediacy, of awareness itself. And this is what the practice points toward. You know, so it may be something that resonates with you, really brings a sense of interest, like, well, that really is something I want to know. Or maybe something that's confusing, it doesn't make any sense. Both are fine. Both are fine. But you may, hopefully by just mentioning this and exploring it, at some point you may hear it in a different light. All right, if we could just sit quietly for a few moments.